Hi, this is Joe Mama. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jamie. Today, host Latara Smith talks with attorney Taylor Ricard of the Kent E. Gibson Law Firm about how prosecutorial overcharging leads to longer prison sentences, wrongful convictions, and more. Then, host Jeff Humfeld talks with Reverend Esther Hosendorf about the efforts in Kansas City to write a plan for here and now based on the framework of the Panthers' 10-point plan. Black Panther Party founder Bobby Seale will be coming to Kansas City to help organize the implementation and realization of today's plan. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and a new feature at the end of the broadcast, Letters from Inside. Now, here is Latara and her guest.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to KKFI 90.1 FM. I'm Latara Smith of the Casey Freedom Project, and this morning I have the pleasure to interview an awesome attorney. Her name is Taylor Ricard. She is an attorney, and she has a lot to tell us today as we speak on the subject of prosecutorial overcharging. Taylor, are you there with us?
I am here today.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really, really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to do so.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Awesome. Now, Taylor, as you heard me say, our subject today is going to be prosecutorial overcharging, okay? And for those listening that don't know what prosecutorial overcharging is, can you provide that definition for our listeners?
Sure. So prosecutorial overcharging is basically when a prosecutor will file charges that they can't really prove. So they'll file charges that the elements necessary to actually prove the crime, they don't have that evidence.
Right. Okay. And, you know, for those who are listening, let's just break it down a little further. Exactly what is a prosecutor and what is a prosecutor's role in our community?
Well, the prosecutor basically brings charges as part of the state. They bring charges against the criminal defendant. And so their role, they actually have pretty broad discretion in filing charges and actually dropping charges as well. So they bring charges, and technically their role is they're supposed to bring charges only when they have probable cause to do so. So if they think that a defendant may not be guilty, or if they have doubts in their guilt, they're technically not supposed to file charges. However, that's not always the case.
Right, right. And so, you know, I want to make it clear for people who are listening, you know, a prosecutor is a powerful, powerful person in our community. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And prosecutors have what's called prosecutorial immunity, which means that no matter what they do in the course of their duty as a prosecutor, they can't be sued. You can't recover civil damages against a prosecutor.
Wow. Wow. That's deep. You know, and like I said, a prosecutor is very powerful. The power prosecutors have to charge people with crimes is most times and often it's overlooked. Okay. So while probable cause is the minimum standard police officers need to make an arrest and the minimum standard to convict, the minimum standard to convict is beyond a reasonable doubt that this person committed this crime. So when
Correct.
We have issues of prosecutorial overcharging, you know, what's even known as prosecutorial overreaching, okay, that's really not fair for the prosecutors to do that, because if you have someone that's being charged with second-degree murder, okay, but actually, you know, what happened was much less than second-degree murder, then it kind of appears that, you know, not only is it unfair, but it also puts that defendant in a position where they have to take a plea. Do you think that prosecutorial overcharging is used to, you know, to negotiate higher pleas?
Yeah, and I certainly agree. A lot of times, so basically how prosecutorial overcharging works is it happens kind of in two different ways. So the first kind of way is when a prosecutor files more charges than they should be filing. So they'll charge multiple counts of a certain offense that really that they only should be charging one count. And then the other way that it happens is that a prosecutor will charge an offense for a higher, more serious offense than what it should be charged. So we see this a lot where any cases involving, you know, murder, they'll always charge a first-degree murder charge when kind of to coerce a defendant into taking a second-degree murder charge just because that would avoid them from getting life in prison, life without parole.
Right, right. And I hear about that as well as I have seen that often. You know, I've seen that often. I've even seen in cases where individuals were innocent and wrongly convicted, okay? And I can't say that I've seen that here in the state of Missouri, but I know in Texas, when I worked over there in Texas and volunteered quite a bit, that there were individuals that actually who wanted to get out of prison. They were most definitely innocent, wrongly convicted, but because they couldn't just actually get their cases overturned, what they end up doing is pleading out to a lesser charge and getting time served so that they could go ahead and get out of prison, but they actually never committed the crime. So I just don't understand, you know, how that happens.
Right. So a lot of times, too, I mean, when you take a case to trial, there is a huge uncertainty. It's a huge risk. You don't know what you're going to get. So a lot of times, someone who may have been a defendant that may have been acquitted, if they were to actually exercise their right to a trial by jury, is so afraid that they're going to get such a long sentence that they'll actually plead guilty to a crime that they didn't commit or one that they absolutely shouldn't be pleading guilty to just because they're so afraid of what's going to happen if they actually take their case to trial.
Right. Well, when you have a case where, you know, there's most death, I mean, you know, like some people really just don't know the system. You know, some people are not, you know, most people are not versed in the law. So when they hear something like, you know, wow, I've been, you know, when they get slapped with, you know, I'm charged with second degree murder. Okay. Their bonds are going to be higher, which mm-hmm. means they're going to be in jail, you know, because their bonds are higher, which if they were charged with the right crime that they committed, if they committed any crime at all, you know, their bonds would be lower and they could stand a chance to go ahead and bond out and get out. But if you're in there and you're on a higher charge, you know, if you've been overcharged, then that means that your bond and everything is going to be higher. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of times, too, basically what happens with that is it not only causes them to have a higher bond or anything, they'll have to serve jail time that they maybe otherwise shouldn't, but it creates a huge issue for somebody's reputation because once those charges have been filed, the damage has already been done. Whether or not they don't actually end up getting convicted of that charge, it can be catastrophic to someone's reputation.
Of course, and I have seen that happen. I've seen people's lives ruined in reference to just what you just said, you know. So, you know, it's a thin line, you know. Is prosecutorial overcharging prosecutorial misconduct?
Yes, I definitely think so. And, you know, there's really not, unfortunately, the plea bargaining process is absolutely essential to the criminal process because if it weren't for that, then their criminal cases would sit in court for so long, there would be no way to move all these cases through the courts.
Exactly.
But it's just unfortunate that there's no really mechanism that this is police just because prosecutors don't ever get in trouble, even those that systematically do this on a regular basis.
Right. I was reading up on prosecutorial overcharging, and I want to read this here because I thought this was very interesting. It says, one of the most common strategies used by prosecutors is to overcharge a defendant. There are a number of strategic reasons why prosecutors may overcharge those accused of a crime. The key reason is that the deputy district attorney or the lead prosecutor knows that they must move a large volume of cases through the court system. The way this is accomplished is via plea bargaining and negotiation. Prosecutors know that when they overcharge cases, okay, that this is going to encourage a guilty plea in exchange for a reduction in the charge of the offense that should have been charged originally. I was knocked off my feet when I read that. What do you think about that, Taylor?
I mean, that's absolutely correct. That's the main reason that this happens is just because there is such, prosecutors have massive caseloads, and they really have such a high incentive to get a defendant to plead guilty just because it's easier on them, and it's more efficient to have a defendant plead guilty because it saves them time from having to hold on to the case because plea bargaining allows cases to be, you know, disposed of quicker. They don't have to prepare for a trial and do all the work that goes into getting ready to try a case.
Right, right. And I know I ask you if prosecutorial overcharging is a form of prosecutorial misconduct, but let me flip it to the defense side. Let's say the defense attorney. If a defense attorney can see that their client has been overcharged, should that defense attorney fight to address that issue and make sure their client is charged correctly?
I mean, well, they can go ahead. Courts have the ability to dismiss charges. They just don't often do so. It's just making sure that, you know, in the jury instructions and all that, that a jury knows that they can, they don't have to convict someone of this more serious charge, and that they know that the jury is aware that that they can convict someone of a lesser offense, and they need to know that they need to prove all the elements that go into a charge beyond a reasonable doubt before they convict someone.
Right, right, right. Because someone asked me that, you know, someone said, you know, hey, listen, Latara, this is my situation. I was charged with this, but once I took my plea and once I, you know, got hold, you know, I was out and I could access law books because, you know, in the county jail, their time is so limited to the law library. You know, they may not even get to go. Most times they don't even get to go. It can be a court order for them. A judge can sign an order saying allow them time to go to the law library. And those orders are continually disregarded. So many times, you know, they don't have access to go to the law library and read up on things. So I had a person that actually took a plea so they could go ahead and get on out. Once they did and they were able to access law books, they realized, hey, I was overcharged. And the question to me was, Latara, if I could see that I was overcharged, I'm sure that my attorney could have saw that I was overcharged. And I don't understand why my attorney did not, you know, address that issue and try to make that, you know, part of negotiations that he had going on for me. And I didn't have an answer.
I think if a defendant pleads guilty to a crime that they most definitely should have, that falls back on the, you know, the defense attorney, because they shouldn't have, you know, advised their client to go ahead and plead guilty to something that they absolutely shouldn't have.
Right.
Because, you know, a lot of criminal defendants, they don't know anything, like you said. They don't know a lot about the law. A lot of them, it's their first time, you know, being in the courtroom, being, you know, having to go to trial, facing all these criminal charges. So they don't know, and so it's really important that an attorney would give proper advice, and if an attorney were to tell a defendant to plead guilty to a crime that they shouldn't, then that definitely would fall back on them. That would be ineffective on their behalf.
Right. And then the first thing I thought about when this person was telling me this is when they take the stand and they agree to take the plea, they are admitting that they've done whatever they're, you know, what they've been accused of doing or whatever they're getting ready to take the time on. So if an attorney knows that their client really didn't do this, but you're telling them, hey, go ahead and take this plea, it seemed kind of backwards to me, because that's like asking your client to, you know, commit perjury, get up there and say, yeah, you did. I mean, I don't know. That's just the first thing that came to my mind.
And right. And I mean, it happens all the time, too. And not only is it, do they plead guilty to something they didn't do or that they shouldn't be pleading guilty to, it also affects their ability to appeal, because if you plead guilty, can't, you know, appeal your case on direct appeal. It limits your ability to appeal your conviction, because you've basically, you admitted to the fact that you committed a crime.
Right, right, right. And that just made me think of something else in a whole nother case. but no, and you're exactly correct. And people don't understand this. And I hope those that are listening, you know, are really paying attention to what we are talking about, because it is such an important issue. And it is very, very, it's not good when prosecutors overcharge. But, you know, unfortunately, it's like that's the way of the game. This is what they do. It's almost like, you know, it's like they pop out of law school and then they become a assistant prosecutor, whatever. And that's the way that they go. And it's not right. Now, Taylor, what type of law, what is your field of law that you work in?
So I predominantly do criminal appellate work. So post-conviction, after someone has been convicted of a crime, we'll kind of step in. We can do direct appeals. Any sort of post-conviction sort of appeal is normally what we do in our office.
Okay. All righty. And so you basically work, you have a lot of cases, I bet you, in your office where individuals are saying, hey, they have what's considered a post-conviction claim of actual innocence, and you guys fight to help to get them out. Is that kind of the area that you work in as well?
Absolutely, yeah. We have multiple clients who have, extremely viable cases of innocence that, that they kind of got screwed over, not had bad attorneys, were basically given bad advice and ended up in prison, a lot of them for life, some of them even on death row. But it's pretty crazy some of the things that we come across in our practice.
Right. And back, I'm just knocked off my feet as I was reading a lot of these issues about prosecutorial overcharging, because we know that it happens. It happens on a daily basis. It's like, what can we as a community do to, address this issue? What can we do? I mean, what can we do to stop this?
I think the biggest thing is that there needs to be some sort of a reform that would hold prosecutors accountable for their actions, just because right now there's no mechanism for them to get in trouble for doing this. So they have absolutely no incentive to not overcharge, because it helps them out, because like I mentioned before, the more cases they can work through the system just by having the charged individual plead guilty, it makes their life easier. So some sort of mechanism to basically monitor their behavior and make sure that this isn't happening all the time, because right now there's really no other way, and aside from holding prosecutors accountable for their actions.
Wow. Everyone, you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI. My name is Latara Smith. I'm with the Casey Freedom Project, and I am interviewing Taylor Rickard, attorney at law, and we are speaking on the subject of prosecutorial overcharging this morning and how it affects our community and what is it that we can do about it to address this issue. And, Taylor, it is. Do you see a lot of cases where there's been prosecutorial overcharging?
Yeah, and I think one of the sort of outcomes that happens a lot with prosecutorial overcharging is that one of the things that occurs is that because prosecutors have the ability they have a broad discretion in order to, file a charge, and they also have broad discretion to drop charges, doing this kind of creates a massive disparity in sentencing outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
So, a defendant, someone that's charged with the same crime, two criminal defendants that have been charged with the exact same crime, same facts, may end up getting widely different sentences just because this occurs. And it just depends on, what the prosecutor feels like as far as offering a plea deal and all that stuff. So that's one thing that really does happen a lot.
Right, right. And, people don't see that this is what's going on. I have something else here highlighted that I wanted to read when I was reading up on prosecutorial overreaching, also known as prosecutorial overcharging. And this absolutely was just was like, yeah, this is what happens on a daily basis. It says there are other advantages that prosecutors obtain by overcharging defendants. Generally, bail is initially established by a bail schedule, which provides for higher bail amounts for serious offenses. Because bail is set artificially high by overcharging, it is more difficult for the families of those who are incarcerated to bail out their loved one. When a defendant must remain in custody while his or her case is pending, there is an increased pressure on the defendant to plead guilty quickly, particularly if it will mean being released from custody. This can be even more unfair for those who have, what they say, immigration issues, because sometimes they plead out a case that was overcharged only to find out that they will be subject to an immigration hold and a potential deportation.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And I just saw a case of that on the news here not too long ago where that actually, the person took a plea deal on a criminal deal and then, of course, they deported them. But, the point that I wanted to pull out of what I just read is what I kind of touched base on before, which is the simple fact that their bail is going to be higher. And if anyone is in the jail atmosphere, okay, because it is not a great one to be in, and you're there and you're just sitting there and they come to you and they say, hey, listen, take this plea. And, you know, you're sitting here and you're looking at the conditions around you like, wow, I want to get out of here. I want to get back to my family. I need to get back to work, you know. And people take those pleas when they were overcharged in the beginning.
Right. Well, yeah, and I think kind of, you know, a way that they do this, and I may have touched on this before, is that prosecutors, when they do overcharge, when they come out with these plea deals to a defendant, it'll make it look like, you know, the prosecutor is being really friendly and they're giving the defendant this awesome deal to have
yes.
them plead guilty, when really it's the charge that they should have been charged with in the first place.
Right, right, right. And I have seen prosecutors also come back and offer a plea deal. And, you know, the person that I was advocating for, had I not sat down with that individual and went over the sentencing guidelines, you know, for that particular crime or whatever, you know, he thought the prosecutor was just giving him this awesome deal. And I'm like, no, dude, she hit you at the maximum is 10 years. And that's what she hit you with. She didn't
right.
negotiate anything with you. But there again, he would have never known that if he didn't, you know, have someone to sit down and go over these types of things with him. Because, you know, everyone just doesn't think, oh, let me study. Let me study guidelines and, you know, I mean, you know, let me study, you know, sentencing guidelines and things like that. You know, what can happen to me? You know, what's the maximum in this type of crime? And if I take this plea, you know, where are they hitting me? Are they hitting me at the maximum? Are they hitting me in the middle? Are they hitting me, you know, on the lower end of the deal? And that's just simply because people don't know. And I think it's horrible that prosecutors, not all prosecutors, take advantage of people like that. I think it's horrible. I really do.
Yeah, like you said, it's not all of them. They're not all evil.
Right.
But there are some that do it, and, you know, the ones that do it keep getting away with it, and that's a problem.
Right, exactly. So, Taylor, why don't you give the people your contact information in case there's anyone listening that wants to speak with you or may have any questions for you? You mind giving your, you want to give your contact information?
Sure. If you have any other questions, you can feel free to call us up at Law Office of Kent Gibson, and our phone number is 816-363-4400.
Okay. And do you have, do you guys have a website that people can refer to?
Sure. Our website is actually under construction right now, so it's going to be getting a new email or a new
okay,
name
awesome.
Here pretty soon. But
okay.
I believe it is kentgibsonlaw.com.
Okay. And I just had a question came in, and I want to ask you this, and they wanted to know, can a public defender be held accountable? Let me see the question that came in again. Can the public defender get in trouble for not advising their client properly?
So after somebody is convicted or someone pleads guilty, there is a procedural mechanism. If the client were to plead guilty, it would be Rule 24035 in Missouri, and if they were to have a jury trial or a trial, it would be under Rule 2915. And under those sort of, this happens right after if a case would either be on direct appeal or if a client pled guilty right after they were sentenced, but you can raise claims of ineffectiveness of counsel. So that sort of issue could be raised in a post-conviction proceeding.
I see. Okay, awesome. Well, you know, Taylor Reed, thank you so much for coming on the show. I know it was kind of last minute that we set this up, but I thank you so much for coming on the show. And I know this information that you have provided us this morning is going to bless someone. And prayerfully, it's not just going to bless them, but it's also going to open their eyes to maybe a judicial system that they may be dealing with and, you know, needed some insight on. So once again, Taylor, thank you so much for calling in this morning. Okay. You guys have a blessed
sure.
day over there at the law firm.
You too.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now the calendar for the week of April 9th. The Kansas City chapter of the Southern Christian Leadership Council hosts a march and rally for peace, taking action on the 50-year anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. This commemoration will begin with a march Friday, April 13th at 5:30 p.m. from 34th and Paseo, Victorious Life Church, to 7th and Prospect in KCMO. The rally will begin at 7 p.m. at Morning Star Baptist Church, 2411 East 27th Street, KCMO. For more information, email them at peace4kc@yahoo.com. That's capital P-E-A-C-E, numeral 4, capital K, capital C, at Yahoo. The Jackson County Bar Association presents Law 101 free legal classes taught by judges and licensed attorneys for the public. The next class will be Saturday, April 14th, 6 to 7 p.m. at the Greg Kleiss Community Center, 1600 John Buck O'Neill Way, KCMO, just east of Paseo and a block north of 18th Street. The subject for this month's presentation will be employment law. Mothers of incarcerated sons and daughters will have their monthly meeting Saturday, April 14th, from noon to 2 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library, 201 East 75th Street, KCMO. If you have a loved one that is incarcerated and need advice and support, MISD has members that may be able to help. My name is Jamie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Up next is Jeff and his guest.
Welcome back to Jaws of Justice Radio. This is Jeff Humfeld, and my guest today is Esther Holzendorf. We're going to be talking about Sankofa for Kansas City, a 10-point plan with Bobby Seale. And Bobby Seale will be coming to Kansas City May 18th and 19th. And for those of you who do not know who Bobby Seale is, he is one of the two men that started the Black Panther Party. And we're going to talk a little bit today about what we're doing here in Kansas City, what is being done here in Kansas City. And I do have to give a little bit of a disclaimer. I have been part of this process. We're writing a 10-point plan, or it might be an 11-point or 12-point before we're all 15. Done. That addresses a lot of the same problems and issues that the Black Panthers did in their day back in the 1960s. Because they're still here. Those problems are still here. So welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio again, Esther.
Thank you, Jeff. It's good to be here as always. Thank you so much, and thank this radio station for allowing us this time. We appreciate it.
First off, I want to remind everyone that the weekend that Bobby Seale is going to be here will be May 18th and 19th of this year, coming up next month.
That's right, next month.
Time's getting short for those of us that are working on this plan.
Yeah.
Esther, this whole thing is something that came from you, and there was a particular incident that set you on this path, so to say. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I will, and I'm not minimizing any of the deaths, but there was one death in particular that happened several years ago. It was a little girl that was killed on 107th in Blue Ridge. Her dad had taken her to the store to get some bubble gum or candy, and when they came out, she was shot. And I can hardly talk about this without crying, because I cannot really get it through my head and my heart how that dad went home and told that mom and that family that little girl wasn't coming home. And it's like her spirit stays with me. And so I'm a mother, a grandmother, great-grandmother, and I just cannot really understand how anyone can go through that, something like that. And so for months, it just stayed with me, and I just wrestled with that thing. And so finally, it just came into my spirit, call Bobby Seale. Well, I don't know Bobby Seale personally. I know who he is, and I know about the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, but I had never met him, and I'm kind of old school. Women just didn't call men unless She didn't know him, especially. But anyway, it didn't stay. It didn't leave me. It just stayed with me. And so I finally looked up his information and I called him. And it took several attempts, but finally we connected. And when we did, and he said, "Hello, this is Bobby Seale." It was like weights fell off of me, Jeff. It was. And I began to cry. I just was trying to tell him about the killings, about the poverty, the gentrification, the lack of care for the elders, the lack of health care for everybody, and lack of living wage job. I was just babbling all this. And I finally said to him, "Brother Bobby, I think I need to hang up because I'm really just not making a lot of sense." He said, "No, you need to keep talking." And he was very patient. He was very kind. And I suppose he and I talked for 45 minutes or an hour. And I finally asked him, I said, "Brother Bobby, can you come to Kansas City and help us to develop and implement a 10-point plan like the Panthers had 50 years ago? Because we have some of the same problems," I said, "but Bobby, they are worse now than they were back then." He said, "Yeah, I can do that." And so that's how it all started.
All right. Let's lay a little bit of groundwork, because the Black Panther Party, the image that most people have of the Black Panther Party is the one that came out of COINTELPRO, the government's issue, what the government wanted us to learn. And the media went along with that. I think a lot of the people in the media were scared of the Panthers, as scared of the Panthers as the government was. There were reasons why the government did what they did, but it wasn't the guns.
No, it had nothing to do with the guns.
It wasn't the guns that were really the reason that the government was down on them. No. So why don't you give us a little bit of background there?
Okay, let's go back and take a look at Bobby Seale and Huey Newton. They founded the Black Panther Party in October of 1966. And from its original six members, the Panthers grew into a political organization of more than 10,000 men and women in 49 chapters. So the Panther Party were not just a bunch of, as Brother Bobby says, "I'm not a hoodlum, I'm an organizer." Huey P. Newton actually graduated from high school illiterate. Huey taught himself to read. He went on to college, earned his PhD, and went to law school. He and Bobby Seale actually met on the campus of Merritt College. They began to talk about the issues of the day. They actually had the 10-point plan before they named the party. So the Panthers' 10-point plan had to do with the same problems that we're having today: police brutality, the killings, the poverty, the lack of health care, the lack of transportation, lack of care, lack of the same things that we have now. So that's why the Panther Party came into existence in the first place. It was not so much that they just wanted to walk around carrying guns, although they certainly had a Second Amendment right to do so. And when they were, that Mulford Act was written, it was written to disarm the Black Panther Party. And the NRA and nobody else spoke up and said that the Panthers have a right to carry arms. They have a Second Amendment right. NRA, nobody spoke up for them. As a matter of fact, the NRA supported Reagan and the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, who, by the way, was that COINTELPRO, that was the group of I'm going to say, investigative law enforcement that labeled the Black Panther Party the most dangerous group to the security of the United States of America. And so they were not, the Black Panther Party for self-defense was not carrying weapons or going around looking for police officers or other people to shoot. That wasn't it. They were standing on their Second Amendment right to bear arms. But they were, because of their programs, that was the threat to the status quo.
Yeah, and I do want to say that at the time that the Black Panthers were active, the NRA was for gun control.
Oh, they were?
Yes. They changed their tune after that. But Let's talk a little bit about the programs that really were what worried the government. The health care clinics that they put together, the feeding of the children, the things of this sort were actually the things that worried them the most. And interestingly enough, some of those things became part of our government. They actually, some of these clinics and the things like that were codified into law.
Yeah, that's right. Because actually, the feeding programs were started by the Panthers. They started the breakfast program for the school children. They had community feeding programs. They had community health care. They had ambulance services. They had transportation. They had schools. As a matter of fact, some of the Panthers and one of their physician friends traveled to China, where they studied acupuncture because they learned that acupuncture could be used to treat addiction and other diseases. They started the sickle cell anemia testing. So, it was programs and it was organizing. They were organizing, as Bobby Seale said, I'm not a hoodlum. I'm an organizer. And he's good at it. He's good at developing strategies. And so it was run like a fine-tuned machine. They were not just a bunch of hoodlums running around, you know, carrying guns to shoot at people. That was not what they were about. They were about organizing the men and the women that made up the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. They were highly organized, very educated, very articulate. They could draw a crowd not with just rah-rah and cheerleading, but with information and the way they presented it, and it was all tied together with what was going on, and they could quote the laws, and they knew the ordinances, and they knew the statutes, and that is what made the Black Panther Party so powerful, was because they were not just out rah-rahing crowds and having rallies and marches, although there's a place for rallies and marches. It gets people's attention. But then you have to have a strategy. You have to have a plan to follow up. What are you going to do after the rally is over?
Exactly. And, you know, this is one of the things that I've learned over the years. And I think I heard Mama C say this one time, that revolution is love.
Yeah, it is.
You know, and it's love for the people. It's love for community. It's love for, you know, the village, so to say.
Yeah.
And you're revolutionary because you're fighting for the village rather than for the moneyed interest.
That's right. That's right.
So,
and revolutionary change, when we look at the civil rights movement, there was a lot of violence that came out of that movement that was directed against the people who were really standing up for equal rights, justice for all. They were being attacked, and they were attacked by the very people that should have been protecting them. See? And so that's, people say, well, we want to figure out how we can work together with law enforcement. No, I beg to differ with that. Now, I'm almost 80 years old, and I was born in Oklahoma. So I know a little bit, but got put off a bus down there, as a matter of fact. And that's how I was 14 years old. That's kind of what got me thrust into, I wasn't really calling myself standing up for civil rights. I didn't want to sit on that back seat because it was dirty. It was simple as that. But anyway, it turned into something that's been a lifetime struggle, because that showed me that there's no equal justice under the law for us. There are some people who just don't like me because I'm Black. There are some who don't like me because I'm a Black female. You know, they don't know me. They don't know anything about me. They just don't like me because I'm Black. And that's something that so many, many people in organizations or groups, they don't really talk about. They don't want to talk about the hard things, the conversations that need to be held. That we can no longer afford to go around playing nicety nice with each other, talking about all of the little nice things that we all want to say. Can't we all just get along, and can't we just all be politically correct? No, we can't. We have to dig down deep and start dealing with cause. That's why I don't like the word violence. Everybody talks about violence. What is that? What is violence? What caused it? If you don't deal with poverty, if you don't deal with lack of health care, if you don't deal with those causes, then why keep talking about it?
Well, when people talk of violence, they immediately think, you know, guns or yeah. knives or whatever. Yeah. But yeah. the fact of the matter is that poverty is a violence it's against a people.
It is, and lack know, of health
care. Lack of health care yeah. is a violence against
and
people.
And people are dying every day just because they don't have health care or they can't afford it.
All right. Talk is very important, being able to discuss these things mm-hmm. and bring them out. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is there comes a time when talk isn't enough.
That's
and
right.
action is what is That's needed. Right. So let's talk a little bit about the 10-point plan that's been put together, that is being put together
yeah.
Here in Kansas City now, how that all started. And I find it very interesting because this has happened in stages.
Yeah.
And the thing I find very interesting is that every time we move, you know, this process moves from one stage to the next stage, more people are added.
Yes.
More people are brought into the
yeah.
process.
Yeah.
So why don't you talk a little bit about how it got started and what, you know, what some of these 10 points are.
Okay. The vision came to me. And one of the first persons that I thought about talking to was Dr. Reverend Wallace Harsfield Sr. And he's the convener of the Human Dignity Economic Justice Task Force. And I'm a member of that and have been since it started. So I went and sat out and talked with him about it because I knew that Wallace Harsfield, Pastor Wallace Harsfield Sr., He's an old warrior, so to speak. He's been out there a long time. And I needed wisdom. I needed prayer. I needed scripture. I needed, I just needed to talk to him. So I talked to him several times. I mean, I leaned on him real heavy, and I'm still leaning on him. And so, because I knew that there were some people in Kansas City who did not support the Panthers. They did not support Pete O'Neill and Mama C and those Panthers. And some of them were in the churches and some of them were pastors. And so Reverend Harsfield Sr., he worked it out so that I was able to sit down with some of the others who are supporters of this. And we were able to talk to some of the pastors and some of the members of the community. And we came to the conclusion that, yeah, this is something that we needed to do. So I called Pastor Sandy with the Concerned Clergy Coalition, Sister Janae Relaford Davis with Camp Choice, talked to you, Jeff, talked to Minister Keith Brown. I just, and talked to Brother Ajama Webster with Black United Front. And so they were very supportive, and they said, yeah, let's do this. So we came together in that original meeting, we just kind of laid some groundwork. Pastor Sandy and Sister Janae Relaford Davis are the facilitators for the meeting. And so they mapped out some how-to things and what not to do things. And so we hammered that out. And so we just kept moving forward. And as you said, with each meeting, our numbers are growing. So this Tuesday, which is tomorrow, at 12 o'clock, we will meet at Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church. Come in on the Linwood side. Everybody's welcome. And come to the fellowship hall. It's at 12 o'clock. We'll meet from 12 to 2. And this meeting will be to hammer out in teams. We have some teams put together, but we need members. We need people to come in and join these teams so that we can continue to hammer out and develop this 10-point plan so that when Brother Bobby Seale comes here, he can help us to begin to develop the strategy that will actually implement this plan. And he will also be at Camp Choice. That's where he's going to be lodging, because we have about 75 young people that he will also be meeting with, and he will be including them in the 10-point plan.
And they're supposedly supposed to work out kind of a youth 10-point
yes,
plan,
yes, yes.
You know, and understand what this process is and in the process, hopefully, you know, bring to the older folks, us mm-hmm. older folks, what their issues are.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
make this document something that's you know, looks to the future,
right,
isn't just about here and now,
exactly,
but is looking to the future.
Exactly. And those young people are coming to the table to give us direction. Us older folks are going to listen, because young people have something to say and older people need to listen. It takes the energy of the young and the wisdom of the aged to get this done. And we need, because these young people are actually living every day. They live every day in whatever's going on. And they did not create this world. They inherited it. So our 10-point plan, quickly, the 10 crucial areas that we have agreed upon include housing, healthcare, education, political power, economics, community unity, senior citizens, legal and justice system, families, and information technology.
Okay, and what we're looking to do is bring people under each of those,
yes,
those areas that we've identified. And we may, like I said before, we may identify one or two more. We actually have a couple more
that we might want to add to
that. That we may add along the line. But, in the Black Panthers Party's 10-point plan, they had their 10 points listed. And then below each of those points, they explained what it was that they felt was important about those points or what needed to be addressed. Mm-hmm. And we are to that point where we need to develop that area underneath where we define what it is that needs to happen, you know, what the problem is, what we need to do as a community forward. Is that
absolutely correct. And as you know, you are serving on this legal and justice system team with us, and so we hammered out some of the details of what we want, because it's not just enough to identify a problem. I mean, you can look around and see all kind of problems. Okay, now what are you going to do about it? And I'm just going to give you, for instance, with the Black Panther 10-point program, their number one thing that they have, their number one point, is we want freedom. We want power to determine the destiny of our Black and oppressed communities. And then they went on to say, we believe that Black and oppressed people will not be free until we are able to determine our destinies and our own communities ourselves by fully controlling all the institutions which exist in our communities. So it's not just enough to identify the problem. We have to come up with some possible solutions, and that's what these teams are about. And you notice I don't call them committees. I call them teams, because I think it's important for people to at least begin to think in terms of, it's not all about I, me, and my. It really is about us. And everybody has gifts. Everybody has talents. And so when we respect each other, respect everybody's opinions, respect their ideas, and everybody be free to express whatever those ideas are. We don't have to always agree, but we do need to respect each other. And so that's what one of the things that Pastor Sandy and Sister Janae, they hammer that home at every meeting, that everybody that has something to say, they will be respected, their ideas and their opinions will be considered, and nothing is going to be just shoved aside, because everybody that's participating in this has equal footing. Everybody is somebody, and we want to hear, what do you have to say about your life and what's happening to you and your children, your grandchildren, your friends' children? What do you have to say about that? That's important.
Yeah, one of the things that I found very refreshing was that it was a matter of no judgment. You know, we can agree to disagree,
right,
but there's no judgment on you. But also something more, which is that we're, you know, like I said, we're trying to, bring everybody into the process,
yes,
and let everybody speak.
Everybody is important, because everybody, it doesn't matter what color you are, it doesn't matter what your gender is, it doesn't matter whether you're educated or not. That's not the important thing. The important thing is you are a human being, you have needs, you have feelings. That's important. Your feelings are important. What you think is important. And nobody, I don't care who it is, that's in a position of authority, nobody has a right to ignore the needs of the people, whatever they are.
All right. We have less than 2 minutes left, so I want you to talk a little bit about what's going to happen on this weekend, May 18th, 19th. You know, there's Friday night, there's a gathering at Metropolitan Baptist Church there on Linwood. Why don't you give a little bit of the information on some of that?
Okay. Let me start out by saying Sankofa. Sankofa is a word in the Twa language of Ghana that translates to go back and get it. There's also a proverb that says it is not wrong to go back and get that which you have forgotten. So on May the 18th at 7 p.m., there will be a community gathering with Bobby Seale at the Metropolitan Baptist Church, 2310 Linwood. That's here in Kansas City, Missouri. And at that meeting, Brother Bobby will be addressing the entire community about the 10-point plan, who the Panthers were, who they were not. And he'll give some background about himself and Huey Newton and why they did what they did. Then on the 19th, we're going to have the Malcolm X birthday celebration. It's going to be an interfaith basketball game with a Q&A with Bobby Seale at 3 p.m. The game will be at 1 p.m. and the Q&A with Bobby Seale will be at 3 p.m. at the Brush Creek Community Center, 3801 Emmanuel Cleaver Boulevard here in Kansas City, Missouri.
Okie dokie. Those are the two things that are open to the public while he's here. Also, I want to remind everyone that at 9 o'clock on Wednesday morning here on KKFI on Alternative Radio, Bobby Seale will be the guest. Right. He will be the one that will be speaking. This is a speech from the past. I don't know exactly, or maybe it's from something recent. I'm not exactly sure. So it's time for us to end this today. You will be finding more information, okay? And but Esther has one more thing she needs to put
very
out there.
Quickly, I wanted to tell the audience about the case for Camp Choice. It's a court case drama where Camp Choice sues the world on behalf of children. And it's going to be Thursday, April the 19th, 2018, at the Southeast High School, 3500 East Meyer Boulevard. And there is a charge for the tickets, I think. It will be at Southeast High School, 3500 East Meyer Boulevard, Kansas City, Missouri, on Thursday, April the 19th, 2018. Thank you.
And we will be giving out more information on all of this as time goes along. We want to thank you, Esther. And this is Jeff Humfeld. Now, letters from prison.
A serious drug crisis in the Missouri Department of Corrections recently resulted in the fatal and near-fatal overdoses of several prisoners in the state's penal system. Immediately, prison officials instituted harsh restrictions on food visits and a number of other privileges, as well as imposing confinement and long-term segregation on anyone accused of drug activity. Since then, a number of complaints have surfaced by prisoners claiming that guards are free-casing inmates just to create the illusion that a serious attempt is being made to eliminate the drug problem. Travis Henderson Eel became one of those prisoners when not long ago a small bottle of prayer oil was found in his possession. Prison officials claimed it contained methamphetamine, so Travis wrote to us the following letter. I am still in administrative segregation at my new plantation site, the South Central Correctional Center, and nothing has changed. The conditions are the same, just new overseers. I wrote the director of the Missouri Department of Corrections and humbly requested a human rights investigation about my current issue along with other prisoners. The reason for this is because there are many prisoners in the Eastern Reception and Diagnostic Center that are being used as scapegoats for this drug issue that took place at ERDCC. Anything that goes wrong behind these gates and fences, it's always the prisoners who get the blame, and society is quick to trust the prison staff members instead of finding out the real facts. One of the main facts is that the prison system continues to receive funds from their state government, but the success rate of transforming prisoners into rehabilitated citizens is very low. How is it that staff members can move up in rank, pay, and position when recidivism is at an all-time high? I suspect this is because prison staff members are not held accountable when they are in the wrong. I am trying my best to deal with this in a civil and respectful manner, but these people have shipped me so far away from my family. This has seriously hindered my ability to do much of anything at all. All of this is because I speak the truth. My unyielding resistance remains firm, and no matter what, I will carry on the fight. My heart goes out to those blind prison staff members, overseers, who don't realize that they are just pawns in the systematic corruption in the criminal justice system that is strictly about warehousing and enslaving human beings for profit. Note, since there is no way of knowing exactly what the substance is that was taken away from Travis, he has requested that it be sent to a lab and tested to substantiate his claims. But prison officials have thus far declined, apparently because they do not wish for Travis to have an opportunity to prove that they are wrong.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.